from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. By a 7-2 vote today, the United States Supreme Court struck down a California law which would have imposed $1,000 fines on stores that sold violent video games to minors, saying it violated free speech rights. The law was passed back in 2005 and authored by then-Assemblyman Leland Yee, but it's never gone into effect, as lower courts had also deemed it unconstitutional. In our next hour of Forum, we'll explore where the debate goes now that the Supreme Court has ruled. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. This morning, the United States Supreme Court struck down a California law designed to restrict the sale of violent video games to minors. The California law, authored by then-Assemblyman Leland Yee and signed into law by Governor Schwarzenegger in 2005, would have imposed as much as a $1,000 fine on stores that sold violent video games to minors. The law defined violent games as those which include, quote, killing, maiming, dismembering, or sexually assaulting an image of a human being. The court rejected the law by a 7-2 vote, with Justices Breyer and Thomas dissenting. We got reaction first from State Senator Leland Yee, who spoke with KQED News this morning.
I'm clearly disappointed by the decision. Once again, the Supreme Court is siding with corporate America and Walmart against our children. I think the saving grace in the decision is that there were a number of dissenting or difference of opinion. Justice Breyer, Justice Alito, and Kennedy. So I think that there is clearly sharp differences in there. Justice Alito, in his opinion, did in fact look at a number of different points and may in fact craft a pathway for us to relook at this particular bill. But I think overall what the court missed out is the fact that these ultraviolet video games are a different technology than books, and it has a different effect on our children. It is not passive looking and passive reading of material. It's actively doing things and changing your brain connection, changing your behavior, and it is that is particularly harmful to our children.
Senator Yee says he was gratified by what he saw as support for the bill, despite the Supreme Court's decision.
I could have just imagined the discussion that was going on among the justices, where they were just really trying to find a way to support our bill, but at the end of the day, they could not. In the Justice Scalito opinion, he was arguing for the fact that this bill, our bill, should in fact be upheld, because on the one hand, while I think the majority opinion was saying that, well, we ought not to regulate this issue because the industry is doing a pretty good job. In the Justice Alito opinion, what he was saying was that, well, but on the one hand, the industry, because of the rating system, is already saying that you ought not to be selling these games to children. So why not have the state reaffirm that particular position? So I just think that there's a lot of fruit in there for looking at a different pathway to get something that will stand up to the strict scrutiny of the First Amendment.
And Senator Yee says he's happy that awareness about violent video games has increased because of his bill.
This has been an 8-year battle. We have raised the consciousness in America about these ultraviolet video games. The industry is taking it a lot more serious now about the harmful effects. They're tightening up and clarifying their rating system. They're doing a lot better job of preventing kids from purchasing these particular games. So I think in that sense, things have improved. But again, part of our job, my job in the state legislature, is to protect our children, and having a law that will codify all the things that we've been concerned about is a lot better to just leave it up to the whim of a particular industry.
That's State Senator Leland Yee. Again, he was the author of the California law that would have imposed a fine on stores that sold violent video games to minors. That law was struck down by the United States Supreme Court by a vote of 7-2 this morning. We also spoke earlier today with Rich Taylor. He's Vice President of Communications and Industry Affairs for the Electronic Software Association.
We're gratified, and we feel, that this validates what we've believed from the beginning of this particular case and others before, that this is a win for the First Amendment and creative freedom of artists and storytellers everywhere, and court affirm what we've always known, that free speech protections do indeed apply every bit as much to video games as they do to other forms of creative expression.
Taylor says the law was misguided from its inception.
It's hostile to the First Amendment, hostile to creative expression and creative works, and suggests government has a role in determining what is appropriate and inappropriate. It's hostile to parental rights, but also it's also a solution in search of a problem that doesn't exist. I mean, frankly, there are other rating systems out there that are not doing the level of enforcement that we are. So why would you start with computer and video games if that's your real true concern? Over 180 groups joined with us across the ideological spectrum and providing briefs supporting our point of view in this case. So this wasn't just, the makers of video games saying, we deserve the First Amendment protection. These are folks from every background, every organization you could possibly name stood up and said, this is not a place for government.
And Taylor says the rating system in place is already working fine in restricting sales of so-called M-rated games. That's the equivalent of an R-rated movie to kids.
If a young person, underage, or anybody, no matter what the age, takes an M-rated game to the register, when it's scanned, it's asked for identification right there at the point of purchase. And if you can't produce identification, you can't buy the game.
That was Rich Taylor, Senior Vice President of Communications and Industry Affairs for the Electronic Software Association. That's the industry group that represents the video game industry. We want to get additional analysis now of this decision and also talk more broadly about the impact of video games on kids. We get additional legal analysis. First, joining us to do that is Margaret Russell. She's Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law. Professor Russell, thanks for joining us. Professor Russell, are you with us? Well, we'll try to get Professor Russell back online. She's going to comment some on the decision today that came down from the United States Supreme Court. Again, the vote there was 7-2. The two dissenting justices were Justice Breyer and Justice Thomas, probably one of the few times those two justices were hand-in-hand in a particular dissent. And we're going to get Professor Russell, when we get her back, to talk more about the way in which this decision came down. There was a lot of debate within the court about the First Amendment and whether or not it applied not only to the question of video games, but also to the question of First Amendment protections for minors. Justice Scalia, in his majority opinion, wrote that our case holds that minors are entitled to a significant degree of First Amendment protection. Government has no free-floating power to restrict the ideas to which they may be exposed. If you have thoughts on this topic as well, as we await our connection with Professor Margaret Russell, Professor of Law at Santa Clara University, you can join us as well at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. And give us your thoughts on the United States Supreme Court decision today, which rejected the California law. They rejected it by a vote of 7-2. Again, the California law was authored by now Senator Leland Yee. At the time, he was an assemblyman, and the law would have imposed a $1,000 fine on stores that sold violent video games to minors. And Professor Russell joins us now from Santa Clara University School of Law. Professor Russell, thanks for staying with us and getting back on the phone line with us. Happy to have you join us.
Thank you.
Give us your thoughts first on the majority opinion that was authored by Justice Scalia. I was reading just a line from it. Let me read that again, in which he said, "Our case holds that minors are entitled to a significant degree of First Amendment protection. Government has no free-floating power to restrict the ideas to which they may be exposed." Was that the key question in your judgment here about whether or not the First Amendment extended fully to people under the age of 18?
I think that was one of the key questions, but really at the heart of the majority opinion, on behalf of actually five justices, although two others agreed with the judgment, at the heart of that opinion was whether or not to carve out a new area of what's called unprotected speech. So as people know, there are certain kinds of speech, obscenity, legally defined obscenity, child pornography, incitement, so-called fighting words that are not protected under the First Amendment, and the government can regulate them freely. And Scalia's opinion spends a lot of time explaining why this can't possibly be another category, a new category of speech that is called unprotected.
So the key question then in that case is whether or not video games, the nature, the inherent nature, I guess, of what a video game is, would be somehow different than a film. And in the view of the majority of the justices, that case just wasn't made?
That's right. And the majority held that the government had not presented what they require as compelling interest, that a compelling evidence that this is what these games consist of. Scalia is famous for very pithy writing. And one in a very long passage, he details all of the works of literature ranging from Grimm's fairy tales to Homer and Odysseus and the other works of art in which there are depictions of violence. And as he says, all literature is interactive. The better the literature, the more interactive it is. So the majority clearly doesn't see a difference between that and the violent video game.
And as you mentioned, Justice Scalia's opinion was the primary vote on this. But both Justice Roberts and Justice Alito also sided, but for somewhat different reasons. Where did they go on this?
Yes, as Senator Gee says, the nuance of the breakdown of votes and opinions is really fascinating, because although seven voted to strike down the law, Alito and Roberts basically said this. They said the law is vague, and under the First Amendment you can't have a vague law because it doesn't give ordinary people notice of what's prohibited. And what's vague about this law is it refers to violent video games, which is a pretty broad definition. But then they went on to say, but we would leave it at that because this is a new area of technology. We need to proceed with caution. But we should give deference to legislators to actually legislate in this area. And we don't know enough about this area of technology to go farther than that.
Does that mean then, Professor Russell, as Senator Yee, I think, seemed to be hoping for, that there is a window in which this law could be recrafted with enough specificity to pass constitutional muster?
I think not, because you had a very clear vote of five who have rejected the idea that this can be the basis of legislation. And as long as the current court is constituted as it is, I think that that will stay. But you do have four justices in the losing count. You have Alito and Roberts, who thought that another law might work. And then you have Breyer and Thomas, who actually would have upheld the law for different reasons.
And give us some sense of their dissent. As I mentioned a moment ago, there can't be that many times when Clarence Thomas and Stephen Breyer are on the same side of a particular decision. But what at heart was their feeling for why this law should have stood?
It's indeed a very interesting group of two. Let me start with Clarence Thomas, because he is so often on the same side of Justice Scalia for what people think of as their originalist opinions. And Clarence Thomas writes a separate opinion saying that the founders actually had no intention to protect the free speech right of minors, and they also had no intention to protect the free speech right of adults or entities such as the Entertainment Merchants Association to speak to minors without their parents' consent. So it's a very restrictive view. He says it's the history and the origins of the First Amendment. Scalia's view of the origins of the First Amendment on behalf of the majority is that the framers didn't intend to shield anybody from depictions of violence, including children. If I might, for a moment, let me go on to Justice Breyer, who is, as you mentioned, not often on the same side in terms of vote with Justice Thomas. But Justice Breyer was persuaded that even though the highest level of scrutiny should apply to this law, as the majority said, he found it compelling that the government had demonstrated that the protection of children would be furthered as a compelling interest. So he writes separately to basically to describe these laws as what he calls virtual target practice. He says, you know, this isn't like literary depictions of violence at all. This is actually people in the position of engaging in target practice.
And we're going to pick up, actually, with that part of this story with our next guest, Professor Margaret Russell, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law. Thanks very much for providing that analysis of today's decision by the United States Supreme Court.
Thank you very much.
And joining us now are Douglas Gentile. He's director of the Media Research Lab at Iowa State University, where he studies, among other things, the effects of video games on children. Professor Gentile, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And we're also joined by Charles Ferguson. He is an associate professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at Texas A&M International University, also focuses on the effects of video games on children. Professor Ferguson, thanks for joining us as well.
It's a pleasure also.
Well, let's dig in for a moment on this question. In effect, really what we heard Professor Russell talk about right before you came into our program, which is whether or not there is something different about video games, this sense that on the one hand, Justice Breyer says there is. For the majority, Justice Scalia says there is not. Douglas Gentile, is there something that's fundamentally different about a video game that means that there ought be regulation of them that's different than other forms of media?
I think that scholars who study this might have different opinions on it. And my personal opinion is that it doesn't seem to be very different from other screen media, that there are reasons why you might expect violent video games to have a larger effect than violent movies or television, because you are actually interactive, you're the actor, you get reinforced for it. But my reading of the research and my own studies does not show a much stronger effect. Now, if we move to other types of media, such as reading or music, then there does seem to be a much bigger effect, but for screen media than for those other non-screen media.
Interesting, because you'd think, I mean, it seems intuitive that because the very interactive nature of this requires the participant to make certain choices, I'm going to zap that person and not this person, I'm going to use this weapon, not that weapon, that very act of engagement would have a larger effect, but not so?
Well, certainly you're right that video games are natural teachers, and this is why educational software is so valuable. When your child plays Read a Rabbit, he or she really does learn to read, and this has been shown across a number of disciplines. If your kids play positive pro-social games, there's some evidence showing that they can actually become more helpful and cooperative, and when they play violent games, they can learn things about aggressive attitudes and feelings, and that, you know, we all know thoughts and, you know, feelings can translate into behaviors. But it doesn't seem to be that much different from what happens when they watch television or movies. Now, it may turn out that future studies will prove that inaccurate, that in fact it does have a different effect, but my reading at this time is it doesn't seem to be that much different.
And we'll get to what the effects overall of media screened, if we can use that term, screen video violence are in a moment. But Christopher Ferguson, weigh in on this as well from Texas A&M, your view on whether or not there is something or not that's profoundly different about the nature of interactivity and the nature of video games.
Well, I actually largely agree with Dr. Gentile on this particular issue this is a claim that has been repeated multiple times in support of this particular law by Senator Yee and other individuals. But at present, there isn't much, if any, evidence to support this kind of, you know, the interactivity makes a big difference. There doesn't really, again, you know, we would probably debate on whether there's any effects there at all or not. But in terms of just, you know, taking the research at face value, there doesn't seem to be much of any evidence to support this idea that there's a different effect for video games because of the interactive nature of those video games. The one thing, too, that's sort of important to point out historically is that you know, kind of historically, whenever new media comes out, there tends to be this kind of argument of this media is different for one reason or another. So the interactivity argument for video games is not terribly unique necessarily. You know, with movie violence, it was that it was visual. With television violence, is that it was available every day. With Dungeons and Dragons, the interactivity, you know, sort of issue was raised again with that game because people were you know, sort of acting out the actual actions of the characters they were playing in that game. So again, on this issue, I would have to agree with Dr. Gentile that there's really no evidence to support this idea that video games are different.
And why do you think that might be true, Christopher Ferguson? If it seems logical that it would, why wouldn't it?
Well, I think it's just one of these issues that it's sort of this historical cultural narrative to media that we kind of like the idea that media has some sort of effect on our behavior, perhaps even a profound effect on our behavior. And I think historically we can usually look back and say, okay, people were worried about comic books, but, you know, that was kind of silly. People were worried about dime novels, you know, that was kind of silly. People were worried about Bugs Bunny, and that was kind of silly. We now know that those previous concerns about media were in error. So now we have to, you know, here's something new comes along, and we're worried about it, so we have to come up with some sort of narrative. Well, if we were wrong about the comic books, we were wrong about the dime novels, why are video games different from all these things? So why are we so worried? And I think we tend to grasp at, you know, something that's different about the new media in order to try to rationalize our fear of them.
Christopher Ferguson, he's associate professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at Texas A&M International University. He joins us along with Douglas Gentile, who's director of the Media Research Lab at Iowa State University, where he also studies the effects of video games on children. We're coming up on a break, Professor Gentile, but outline briefly, if you would, where you come down on the side of whether or not these violent video games or violent media of any kind, movies, whatever, have an effect on children.
Well, I think the best type of study to look at this are meta-analyses. And a meta-analysis is a study of studies where you combine all the studies that have been done and try to see overall, you know, even though some studies might differ from others, what's the big overall picture? And Dr. Ferguson has done some of these, and a colleague of mine, Dr. Anderson, did the largest one of over 130 studies with 130,000 people in these studies. And generally, it finds that the more people play violent video games, the more they have aggressive thoughts, the more desensitized they seem to become to aggression, the more they have physiological reactions, that, you know, that adrenaline rush you get when you're playing is really adrenaline, and it can influence behaviors.
So it has an effect. And what you're arguing is that that effect also would have come about from watching violent movies, that there isn't a distinction really between the two. Is that right?
I don't see one. Dr. Anderson actually does. So I think there is some – it's too early to have a definitive answer on this. But I think this really shouldn't surprise anyone. If the games didn't influence us, you know, gamers have a really special word for it. They call it boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, in fact, we seek being influenced by the media. That's why they're so compelling to us. We want to be influenced by them. And what's funny is then we often want to turn around and pretend that, oh, it doesn't influence me, the same way we do, say, with advertising. We know it works in general, but we don't want to believe it might influence me or my child.
I suppose another way to put this is it wouldn't be an $18 billion a year industry if it had no effect. So
exactly.
We'll come back and talk about what that effect is. Do violent video games have an effect on kids, even if that effect is not different than watching a film? And we'll take your calls on this subject as well. Here's the number, 866-733-6786. If you're a parent, how do you feel about this issue in terms of your own children's exposure to video games? Join us at 866-733-6786. More in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in this morning from Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, the Supreme Court's decision earlier today to strike down a California law. They voted on a 7-2 margin to reject the law that had been authored by now Senator Leland Yee 6 years ago in 2005. That law would have imposed as much as a $1,000 fine on stores that sold violent video games to minors. Our guests this half hour include Christopher Ferguson, associate professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at Texas SANM, and Douglas Gentile, director of the Media Research Lab at Iowa State University. We'll take your calls soon, too, as part of this half hour. 866-733-6786 is the number. Email us at forum@kqed.org. We'll get to your calls in 1 second, but I want to just let you finish up, Douglas Gentile, and then get a response from Christopher Ferguson on the effect, which is, of course, a key question here as far as parents go in particular. You were describing that people who watch violent video games wind up having more aggressive thoughts. Same would be true of watching more violent movies. Can you tell us with any more specificity what that means and whether or not whether there's any evidence to suggest that having violent thoughts leads to violent action?
Well, one of the things we know about aggression is that it's multi-causal, and that there are, in fact, the U.S. Surgeon General's report on youth violence lists about 100 known causes of aggression, and media violence is one of them. It's not the biggest. It's also not the smallest. It's, you know, right there in the middle of the pack, and what that means is it's one issue that has something to do with why someone might behave aggressively. It's certainly not the kind of thing, and no researcher is saying, oh, these games are going to turn our kids into school shooters. It's part of a bigger pattern of habitual thinking and practice, and we all know that, you know, your grandmother was a great neuroscientist. She said, practice makes perfect, and she was exactly right. And so if what kids practice in a game is being very vigilant for enemies, and when they see one, they quickly respond with an aggressive response. When they get into school and they get bumped in the hallway, there seems to be a change that they stop assuming it was an accident. They start attributing hostile motives to other people around them because they've practiced being hypervigilant for hostile motives. And then once they've made that little change in thinking, they're probably more likely to respond somewhat aggressively, say something unkind or push back, and of course that, you know, that could build to something much more aggressive. So I think that's the level of aggression, you know, most aggression researchers are talking about when they talk about, if you practice thinking this way and feeling this way and having kind of learning a script that when provoked, what should you do? Well, I'm guessing no one in our audience thought, ask for more information, or seek an arbitrator. But that first thing that comes to mind is retaliate. And we know that, you know, human thinking, often you go with your first response. Hopefully you have a little more time to think about it and try to decide, is this the best thing? But a lot of human behavior is we go with the first thing that comes to mind. And if this is what you practice thinking over and over and over, it makes it a little more likely that you would have an aggressive response when provoked.
And Charles Ferguson, your response sounds like Douglas Gentile is saying a modest effect, probably only in combination with a number of other factors that would have to be in play before video games themselves would have an effect. But if you've practiced it, it might still prompt a certain kind of behavior.
Well, I think Dr. Gentile and I would agree on some things and probably not agree on some other things. I'm certainly in agreement with Dr. Gentile that we have to be careful to point out that this kind of research is not generalizable to youth violence or to serious acts of violence like school shootings. So I certainly agree with him on that. And I also agree with him that aggression is multi-causal, and we really have to look at things, you know, from, you know, the idea that multiple things are interacting with each other, biology, environment, so on and so forth. The question then becomes is video games one of those things? And that really is where the debate, comes down to. I want to touch on a couple of things that Dr. Gentile mentioned. First, the meta-analyses. It's important to point out that there actually have been three sets of meta-analyses. As Dr. Gentile mentioned, myself, I've done one set. Dr. Anderson has done another. And there's been a third set by John Sherry, who's also done some meta-analyses on this issue. Of that, two of the three meta-analyses agree that the effects of violent video games are either zero or near zero. And it's only the third that came to the conclusion that violent video games can have a serious effect on aggressiveness. So it's important to point out that there actually isn't any agreement among the meta-analyses that have been done on this issue.
And again, meta-analyses, these are big collections looking at a large group of studies.
Right, they're basically trying to, you know, sort of smooth out the differences. I mean, that's kind of a rough way of putting it, but where there's controversy in a field, they're trying to say, well, what is sort of like the, you know, what does the average study kind of say out of all of this? The other issue with meta-analyses is they have this kind of, you know, junk in, junk out kind of phenomenon, which means that if the studies that go into them are of poor methodology, there's nothing the meta-analysis can do to fix that.
And where do you come down, Professor Ferguson, on though this question of if you've practiced it as in Douglas Gentile's example, if you've practiced how you respond by way of a video game, then when you get bumped in the hallway, you're more likely to bump back.
Well, I think that this comes down to this assumption that, you know, is very pervasive in this research field, that individuals are unable to distinguish from the reality of, you know, being in school and the fiction of being in a video game. It kind of takes this practice idea and, in my opinion, generalizes it far beyond where it can go and far beyond where the data can go. So, you know, for instance, you know, children begin to develop reality testing, you know, beginning fairly early on in life. And it's not something that switches on like a light, of course, that, you know, you could probably point to 40-year-olds who can't do very good reality testing. But it's something that they develop through their early years on into their teen years. But one of the first things that kids do look for is the context of the information that they're getting. Is it something that they're getting from a story, or is it something that they're getting from an authority figure? So they tend to assume, sometimes wrongly, that if information is coming from an authority figure, that it's probably true. And if it's coming from a fictional universe, then it's probably not true. And so kids, certainly by the time that they're in elementary school, are using that, you know, perhaps imperfectly, but they are using that to judge information. So I would say that there's really no evidence to support this idea that simply practicing the aggressive actions in a violent video game actually make people more likely to engage in those kinds of actions in the real world. And I think it's important to point out that the societal data appear to bear that out, that if you look at sort of the relationship between video game sales and youth violence, that as video game sales have soared in popularity, they've, I think at this point, surpassed movies in terms of the income they make, that youth violence is at its lowest level in 40 years. Now, I am careful to point out two things. That does not mean that video game violence is the cause of that youth violence decline. I don't think that it is. I think that's kind of a random correlation there. But it does point out that if video games, you know, video game violence were to have the, you know, supposedly devastating effect, that's a word some scholars have used, the devastating effect on youth, that the societal data doesn't match with that.
Let me hold you there, if I might, and we'll get back to that question and get Douglas Gentile to weigh on that too. But a number of listeners want to get in on our conversation, and let's let them give their thoughts on this too. Feshi joins us first from San Francisco. Feshi, go ahead.
Hi, I just have a couple of comments. One is, I think it's a pity that the researchers, I'm assuming maybe, that they don't have direct access to youth who are playing that. I mean, in real world, not in, you know, in controlled environment. That what is different between the youth going to watching a violent movie and playing a video game is that you go and watch a movie, come back, there are scenes in it, maybe 30 minutes in 2 hours, maybe 45 minutes in 2 hours, maybe 1 hour. But then you come back and it's a done deal. Whereas video game, you're playing, I have two teenage sons, and they have friends. So I have, I'm watching it firsthand. And they watch hours. They play hours, 2-3 hours, 4 or 5 days a week. So it's, you know, the exposure, the repetition to violence. And it's constantly. It's not like a scene. It's constant. Like Call of Duty is a constant violent game. And it's 2-3 hours of it. To, you know, 4 or 5 days a week. I mean, there's no comparison. And the adrenaline rush that they get, then they miss it when they don't play that. Everything else is pretty boring.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting point. Yeah, Feshi, thank you. Thanks for adding that in. What about that, Douglas Gentile? Do you compensate that for that or replicate that in the lab? This idea, as Feshi is suggesting, that what's different, even though you had said earlier that there aren't really different effects between movies and video games, is that video games, you play them over and over and over and over.
Well, this is one of the reasons why we would theoretically expect there to be a difference, because we do know from the TV and movie violence literature that if the violence is prolonged, that then it can have a bigger effect. And as she's right, in, you know, a movie, you don't, even a violent movie is not violent all 2 hours of it, but a violent game often is. But how do we compensate for this? Well, we compensate for this with different types of studies. Some are experimental studies. We're highly controlled, and we can look at causal effects immediately after playing. Some of them are correlational studies where we can see what's happening in the real world, in homes or in classrooms. And some are longitudinal studies where we track children across multiple years. So in one of these that I've conducted, we've been following 3,000 children for 3 years now. And what we're finding is, and so we're not controlling anything. We're just letting them tell us what do they play at home, and we're finding out how aggressive they are and how they aggressively they think. And what we're finding is the more they play violent video games, they do change to start thinking more aggressively, which then does seem to show up in some of their low-level aggressive behaviors. And conversely, if they're playing pro-social games where they help other characters, they actually form more empathy, and that shows up in their more helpful and cooperative behaviors.
And where
so
do you come down?
It's important to do all of these types of studies.
Yeah, and tie that in, if you would, to what Professor Ferguson was saying earlier about kids, though, have the ability to distinguish between between what is fiction and what is fact. So even though they might have practiced these activities, as you were describing earlier, they can separate that out into the real world of school.
Well, that's exactly correct. But this fantasy reality distinction, I think, is somewhat of a red herring. Just because you know something's fake doesn't actually keep it from having an effect on us. And again, as I mentioned, we all know playing a game is not real. It's just a game. But in fact, if you're playing a violent game, you know, studies do show that your body releases more epinephrine and norepinephrine and testosterone. These are the so-called stress hormones that you would actually have if I really punched you. That your body really has a full fight or flight reaction, and that's part of the fun of it. Even though you know it's just a game, you do get this hyper arousal from playing the game, and that's what makes it so exciting to play. So I think just because we know it's fake doesn't mean it has no effect, the same way that all adults know advertising is fake, but it still influences us.
Yeah, interesting. Let's hear more from our listeners. Kathy joins us next. Kathy, go ahead, please.
Thank you. One of your guests mentioned that kids can be desensitized by playing too much video games, and I'm wondering how that affects the behavior of bystanders, as in bullying situations or other situations where there's aggressive behavior happening, whether because they've been desensitized, they are no longer involved in trying to stop it.
So,
I'll take my answer off.
Just to be sure I understand your question, Kathy, it's whether or not because people who have watched video games and are used to seeing violence might be less likely then to intervene and stop violence when they happen. Is that the question?
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Kathy, thank you. Christopher Ferguson, you want to weigh in?
Sure. I also want to make sure to point out that, you know, as we talk about this literature, that there is not consistency. And you know, Dr. Gentile just mentioned a longitudinal study that, you know, we're doing a similar study here where, you know, thus far we haven't found any relationship between increased, you know, playing of violent video games and aggressive behavior in the real world. And that includes bullying. Interesting. So it's sort of interesting that the caller mentioned that particular issue, that we can't find any evidence that playing more violent video games or watching more violent television plays any role in bullying behavior whatsoever. The issue of desensitization is an interesting one. Again, the studies of sort of, you know, pro-social behavior are also inconsistent, that there are some studies that suggest that, you know, again, playing violent video games may decrease helping behavior. There are others that suggest the opposite, that perhaps the team-oriented nature of some of these games where people actually help each other in these violent games may actually increase pro-social behavior. And again, it's important to refer back to some of the societal data and that, once again, in this era in which there are you know, increased consuming of video game violence among youth, that youth are more involved in civic behaviors and volunteering than they have been, again, in the last, you know, 40 years. It's important to point out that, you know, there's been this also this, you know, contrast made with advertising effects. It's important to point out that advertising effects and the effects of fictional media are not the same, and that we're making kind of an apples and oranges comparison here. Advertising effects, I know, particularly as adults, we're all sort of aware that we have to be wary of what occurs in advertising, but advertising does at least, you know, purport to be truthful. Now, we all know that it oftentimes isn't, but it isn't really a fictional kind of media.
No, I understand.
The other thing for advertising to be successful is it really doesn't require a major shift in behavior. I mean, for Pepsi to make millions of dollars, they just need to get you to stop drinking Coke. When we're talking about the effects of violent video games, we're really making you're really discussing people changing in a much more fundamental way, from shifting to a presumably, you know, from a presumably peaceful person to someone who is, you know, much more aggressive. So I think we have to be very careful about making this kind of comparison between advertising effects and the effects of fictional media.
Douglas Gentile, if you want to respond on that, do. But I also would like you to respond to this other broader point that, Christopher Ferguson has made about the fact that there isn't any big epidemic of youth violence these days. So on its face, there isn't sort of evidence to suggest that as video game sales go up, that people are acting in a more violent way.
Well, he's exactly right about that. I think where he and I disagree is how to interpret that, that's a societal level of effect. For things to show up in crime statistics at the societal level, it has to be very extreme. It has to be attempted murder or aggravated assault. And most, if not all, of the researchers in this area don't actually expect to see effects at that level. What we expect to see is much more low-level behaviors. And I think even bullying is not at the lowest level, because that's a repeated and habitual type of behavior for bullies. And what I think most of us are saying is that it makes you more prone to have an aggressive response when you're in a context where that is one possible thing. So you've been bullied or you're being provoked. So I wouldn't expect it actually to shift societal values like that.
Let me ask you both just real briefly on your sort of advice to parents part of this. I mean, you have differences, but neither of you are saying that watching video games is going to turn someone into the next school shooter. So what degree of comfort should parents take from that? Or do you both feel, even though there aren't necessarily huge demonstrable effects, that this is an activity that that parents ought to monitor more carefully? Douglas Gentile first.
Well, I think that, yes, anything that gives parents more power and more control is a good thing. And the studies, when looking at parental monitoring of their children's media, shows that it's a powerful protective factor for kids. When parents do look at the ratings on media products and use those to help decide what their children can or can't watch, that's actually a really good thing for kids. Those kids get better grades in school. Those kids get into fewer fights. Now, the skeptic's argument, and everyone should be skeptical, is, well, maybe that's not about using ratings. Maybe that's about being a more involved and better parent. And my response is, well, I don't really care, because you can't just tell parents, be a better parent. You need to tell them how. And this is this very specific thing that makes parents more involved, gets them involved. Say, there's a rating on the box. You should learn it. You should use it. And what surprises me in this overall debate, actually, is how much time we've spent focusing on restricting children's access to games rather than on what would be a much more effective public policy, in my opinion, is how do we get better ratings, make them more effective so they're actually better better tools for parents to make better choices.
And Christopher Ferguson, just real briefly, I assume your view is, even though you don't think there are big effects here, it's not something that you would necessarily say to parents, the more the merrier, have your kids watch as much as possible.
Right. I mean, I actually agree with most of what Dr. Gentile just said. I think that really the key issue here is the parents being involved and participating in this process. I mean, I think I tend to view this as kind of a moral versus harm issue. I mean, I think that what's perhaps been the wrong track in a lot of this is we've gotten so focused in on this idea that video games harm children. I mean, that was really the essence of the California law, this idea that it was harm going on there. I think we're getting to the point where the data is really becoming clear that there's really no harm that's going on there. But that doesn't mean that we really, expect or want all of our kids to be playing Grand Theft Auto. And I certainly would encourage, just like Dr. Gentile just did, I would really encourage, parents to become more familiar with the rating systems and to use them. Even if it's not an issue of harm, I mean, as a parent myself, just morally, I wouldn't want my child, to be exposed.
Right.
Not because I think he's going to be harmed by it, not because I think he's going to become more aggressive. I just find it inappropriate.
And let's hear from
a scientific study to back me up on that.
And let's hear from more of our parents who are listening to this program as well. Marie in Los Altos.
Yes, hi there. I have three sons and a daughter, and the daughter does not play video games, and she doesn't date guys that play video games because she's noticed that that's all they do is play the games and or computer-type games. But my question has to do more with addiction to these games. I'm sorry if you already covered that, but because I tuned in a little late. But we had actually, when our kids were young, Mortal Kombat was new, and I wouldn't allow it in my house because I noticed how my sons behaved when they came home from having played it at their friends' houses. And now that all of them are adults, you know, they obviously can play whatever games they choose to play, and sadly, some of them still are into their 30s and or you know late 20s and into their early 30s, and you can just tell the difference in their demeanor, in their patience level. One of my sons went into the military, and another one owns guns. My husband and I never ever owned any guns, and the third one goes and does target shooting with his two brothers. And I just can't help but think there's got to be some correlation here.
Yeah, Marie, thanks.
And I'd like your comments about addiction, please.
Yeah, thanks, Marie. Douglas Gentile, a quick response, please.
Well, I've been studying what's being called video game addiction for 10 years now, and I started thinking, wow, this is, you know, parents talk about this as an addiction, but that can't be what's really happening, because an addiction means more than do it a lot. It has to mean damage to functioning, damage to school functioning, social functioning, occupational functioning. I thought, that's not what's really happening. So I started studying it from that much more clinical and conservative way, thinking that I would find that, you know, there was nothing there. And it turns out I was wrong. For a substantial portion of youth gamers, they would classify as being addicted by say, the same type of standards that we use for gambling addiction. And we're starting to see across the world in a number of different cultures very similar numbers showing up about the number of kids who would be considered addicted to games, somewhere between, depending on the study, somewhere between about 5% and about 14% is the newest nationally representative study in Taiwan, for example, of gamers that are taking real damage to their lives because of how they're playing. Now, I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions about this. What type of disorder is it? Is it primary or secondary? What would be the best way to treat it? Because the research on this is so new, but it does look, at least in the initial research, that there is something there that you know, I didn't think there would be, but it looks like there is.
Let me just ask a quick combination of emailed questions and get your view on this. Christopher Ferguson, a number of people are writing in about if there's a connection between video games and youth crime, in particular gangs. One person writes in, we have fairly ample evidence of criminal youth mentioning certain video games as contributing to their crimes. Another listener writes in, as far as youth gangs go, the ones that acquire guns and recruit kids, do they play video games, or would it be a good thing if they played video games and work off their hyperarousal that way? Do we know anything about the connection between gangs and whether or not people who participate in violent behavior in gangs have watched a lot of video games?
Yes, well, a little bit. I mean, that's not usually the primary focus of much of the research. I do some outcome studies of gang involvement and such, and there again, there doesn't seem to be much of any correlation, you know, one way or the other between, you know, video game violence exposure and gang activity. You do sometimes find that, you know, that youth that commit a particular crime, you know, will make some kind of comment about, oh, you know, I you know, saw this in Grand Theft Auto or whatever else, but you have to keep in mind that criminals of all ages try to deflect blame for what they've done onto anything they can think of, whether, you know, it's a video game or, you know, society, or their mother didn't take them to the zoo when they were four or whatever else. These are obviously self-serving attempts to deflect responsibility. In terms of the issue of, you know, do playing video games, you know, reduce aggressiveness, something that's called the catharsis hypothesis, it's important to point out that at this point, there's, you know, just as I would say that there's no data to support the idea that video game violence increases aggressiveness, there's really very little data to support the idea that it decreases it either. So we have to be a little bit careful about that. The only thing that's come out that's sort of intriguing is not really this catharsis idea, but some economists, Mike Ward and Scott Cunningham, have done some research that have suggested that simply the act of keeping people busy so that violent movies and violent video games, while they're playing them, they can't be out in the streets, you know, shooting people, essentially. So it's not really that the video games necessarily change the minds or the attitudes of the individuals, but simply by keeping them busy, it may reduce youth violence. That's kind of an indirect way. So, but, you know, just as, you know, I'm really not a supporter of the idea that video game violence causes aggressiveness. I don't really consider myself a supporter of this catharsis.
We're about out of time, so I just want to get a last quick thought from all of you. And a number of emails coming in from people who say, you know, these may be the studies, but that's not my experience. Christina writes in, I'm an early childhood mental health specialist. I'm disturbed and outraged by the argument that video games have little effect on children. I see the negative impact of exposure to violent media on my young clients on a daily basis. So there's this sort of visceral response to this, even though maybe the science isn't entirely there. So, Douglas Gentile, just take that on, if you would, please.
Sure. Well, here's where I think, you know, you have to realize scientists love disagreeing with each other. And the funny thing is, although Dr. Ferguson has done meta-analyses, in fact, his show almost the same effect size as Dr. Anderson's, at least for aggressive thoughts and aggressive feelings. But then he interprets them as being fairly, you know, very small and perhaps meaningless, whereas Dr. Anderson goes the other way and says, well, these are really big and very meaningful. And so it's not that the studies aren't there. There are lots of studies there showing an effect. The question is, how do you interpret that? How big is it relative to other types of risk factors for aggression?
And
because
we'll have
that's the big question that's still unanswered, I think.
And we'll have to leave it there. I wish we had more time to consider this more fully. A lot of reaction from our listeners and emailers this morning to this. We'll continue to try to sort it out, because even though the Supreme Court has decided, obviously there's a lot still to be decided about the impact of video games on young people. Thanks both to Christopher Ferguson at Texas A&M and Douglas Gentile from Iowa State University. Earlier, we heard from Margaret Russell, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.